Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest shakeup in the White House with the Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, unceremoniously fired to be replaced by General John Kelly, the head of Homeland Security. Chris Whipple, a writer, documentary filmmaker, journalist, and the author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, joins us to discuss the challenges facing the four-star Marine general in trying to restore regular order to a White House without a chain of command, with competing power centers and various aides enjoying walk-in privileges into the Oval Office. We will look into whether a mercurial president who enjoys humiliating subordinates and is incapable of taking responsibility for anything, particularly if things go wrong, can be weaned away from his power-hungry delusions that he and his families are America's rulers and learn to govern. Then we'll look into the new White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who might be part of a wider power shuffle in which the embattled Attorney General Jeff Sessions is moved to Homeland Security so that Trump can put someone in at DOJ who will fire the special counsel to end the Russia probe. Michael Cohen, a former State Department chief speechwriter for the United States, representative to the United Nations, who was a columnist for the Boston Globe, where he wrote an article back in April, Homeland Security's John Kelly is unhinged, joins us to discuss Trump's new chief of staff and whether he can rein in his boss, who more and more observers are suggesting is unhinged. Then finally, we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, to speak with veteran Latin American journalist with the BBC and The Guardian, Phil Gunson, now the Andes Project senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. He joins us to discuss today's vote that the opposition are boycotting in the for a constitutional a constituent assembly that will end democratic representation in Venezuela, leading to the possible arrest of elected legislators and the installation of a Cuba-style government led by President Maduro, who is supported by less than 20% of his countrymen. And joining us now is Chris Whipple, who is a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth behind-the-scenes look at the men who have been the president's closest advisors from interviews with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents, whose members have included Rahm Emanuel, Dick Cheney, Leon Panetta, and Don Rumsfeld, a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS's 60 Minutes and ABC News's Primetime. Chris Whipple is the writer and executive producer of The Spymasters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Whipple.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And let's start with the suggestion that some are floating that the getting rid of Reince Priebus and bringing in General Kelly might be part of a wider power shuffle in which the embattled Attorney General Jeff Sessions can somehow be moved to Homeland Security so that Trump can appoint someone at DOJ to fire Robert Mueller, the special counsel. Do you give that any credence?
Not really. You know, that strikes me as too clever by half, perhaps, for this White House and this president. What I do know is that none of that will matter. Nothing really will matter unless he can get the White House right. And I think this is a, this so-called reset, is a chance, but a really slim chance of somehow righting this completely dysfunctional presidency, which really is unprecedented in its chaos and its inability to do anything right.
So from having studied all the most recent chiefs of staff and written about it, Chris Whipple, in your new book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, just explain briefly to the audience the role of the chief of staff, or at least how it should function, where he is the right hand of the president and controls the flow of both paperwork and people in and out of the Oval Office and creates the kind of system that makes the trains run on time.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of the position. The White House Chief of Staff is not only the president's gatekeeper who creates time and space for the president to think, but he's the person who controls the information flow. He's the honest broker of information, making sure that every decision has information teed up on every side of the issue. He is the person who controls communications, making sure that everybody's on the same page. He's the person who's in charge of speech writing. He's the person who's in charge of executing the president's agenda. And maybe most important of all, he is the one person who can walk into the Oval Office, close the door behind him, and tell the president what he doesn't want to hear. Two of the best at that were James A. Baker III under Ronald Reagan, Leon Panetta under Bill Clinton. Those were guys who knew how to do that. Sadly, Reince Priebus and frankly, too many people in the West Wing at the moment are sycophants and enablers of Donald Trump's worst instincts. And that's one of the reasons we are where we are.
Well, it's difficult to shed too many tears for Reince Priebus if you recall the round robin around the cabinet table recently, where it's known as the dear leader or the great leader moment, where Donald Trump literally forced all of his cabinet members to praise him. And the most unctuous of all of them, I think, was Reince Priebus, who said how blessed he was to be working for the great man. The only person, by the way, in that entire cabinet that didn't didn't display that sort of grotesque fealty and sycophancy was General Mattis. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty sorry bunch of people. But do you think though that that Kelly? I mean, everybody keeps thinking we've got some adults in the room there. Mattis, but he's already just taken a vacation. So is Tillerson. The other guy, McMaster. Rumors are that Trump doesn't even speak to him anymore and doesn't listen to him anymore in particular. So let's talk about that. Is that a delusion, the idea that there are adults in the room in this White House?
Well, it may well be. Let me just say one thing about generals and the notion that somehow we can maybe rest easier because the generals will bring order to chaos. Certainly hasn't happened yet. And even with Kelly, I think that the odds are very long, really stacked against him. Because just to step back for a second, generals don't have a great track record as White House chiefs. The only modern chief who was a general was Al Haig, who lasted a couple of days, more than a month, under Gerry Ford. Gerry Ford, by the way, thought he could run the White House much the way Donald Trump likes to, or with a similar model. Ford had people coming and going, senior aides, all with equal access. Nobody empowered as first among equals. He called it the spokes of the wheel, with Ford, the president, at the center. Well, it was a disaster. And within a month, he was begging Don Rumsfeld to come in and take charge as an empowered chief, which is what happened. But I think, so with Kelly, the real challenge is, the definition of insanity would be for John Kelly to think that he can run the White House with the same mandate, the same authority that Reince Priebus had. We saw what happened. It's been a six-month disaster, nothing accomplished. And that will be the case unless Kelly can be clearly first among equals. That means everybody reports through him to Donald Trump. Scaramucci cannot be reporting directly to Trump. Scaramucci, the colorful, shall we say, communications director. And quite frankly, I think that Kelly has got to demand that if Donald Trump wants to tweet, that Kelly had better have a look at those tweets before they go out. So how likely do we think Kelly is to get that kind of authority? Pretty unlikely, but he needs it.
And again, I'm speaking with Chris Whipple, who's a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Well, that would mean that Kelly's going to have to sleep on the couch in the East Wing, doesn't it? Because exactly. Trump tweets at like 4 and 5 in the morning.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, look, I mean, the history of, never before in the history of the presidency has a president been able to just send irrational thoughts out into the world unchecked. I mean, there's a reason why presidents have White House staffs and communications directors and chiefs of staff. You can't run away. I mean, we saw just how effective his ban on transgender military personnel turned out to be when he tried to announce it by tweet. It's just a recipe for chaos and disaster. And God help us if we actually get into a real crisis, which we've been spared so far.
Well, even New York Post, a Murdoch paper, and Murdoch is apparently one of the people that talks to Trump almost every day and tries to advise him. And, of course, he's created this kind of media bubble in which Trump's supporters inhabit. And while, for example, outrageous display in front of the police in Suffolk County a couple of days ago, where Trump called upon the police to rough up suspects and, basically encouraging police brutality, while most people were shocked by that, including police professionals, the bubble, the people inside the Fox Breitbart bubble, probably thought that was great. But the one little departure that seems to be happening there with Murdoch's devotion to Trump is the cover of the New York Post that showed a picture of the reality show Survivor with all of the various characters. And if you go back through the more recent Trump experience in the campaign, it was a reality show. He kicked everybody off the island, and then he was the last man standing. And that seems to be the way that he operates the White House. And apparently he was angry at Priebus for being so supine in the face of these outrageous, vulgar diatribe from Scaramucci, who humiliated him in public in the most disgusting way. And Trump apparently was angry that Priebus didn't fight back. And it's just like he was producing a reality show, not running the United States.
Well, that's the troubling thing about all of this. Among a lot of troubling things. But the notion that Donald Trump is maybe less interested in governing than he is in creating chaos and a reality show and to be a disruptor. He's a great disruptor. He's shown clearly in the last 6 months that he has no idea how to govern. And therefore, if you have an outsider president with no idea what he's doing, then he needs an empowered chief of staff more than ever. I mean, more than any of his predecessors, Donald Trump, of all people, needs to have a chief of staff who is first among equals to execute his agenda and tell him what he doesn't want to hear. How likely is that to happen? Maybe not very likely, but it's the most critical thing at this point.
So, do you think then is there anybody out there? I mean, especially the daughter's supposed to have influence. Well, that did a lot of good over climate change. Jared's supposed to have influence, but he seems like a total lightweight. and whose excuse for having all the great portfolios with more responsibility than anybody on the planet, just about, his excuse to the Senate Intelligence Committee was about that meeting that they took with these Russian spies offering dirt on Hillary, that, that basically he was inexperienced. And that's the excuse. The guy with the most responsibility, apart from the president, is inexperienced. So I don't see anybody around there, and so we're all counting on this four-star Marine General.
So, trying to be constructive here. It's not the first time that we've seen a White House riven by ideological divisions and competing power centers and family getting involved. The Reagan White House was, you know, when Ronald Reagan called Howard Baker to try to get him to, who after Don Regan was fired for hanging up on Nancy Reagan, you may recall. Mm-hmm. When Ronald Reagan called up Howard Baker to ask him to take the job, he got Baker's wife, who said he was at the zoo. And Reagan said, well, wait till he sees the zoo that I've got for him. It was a pretty wild ride, the Reagan White House. And you had Nancy Reagan, and you had Mike Deaver, and you had the so-called true believers, the people who wanted Reagan to be Reagan, against the pragmatists led by James Baker. In that case, Baker was so savvy and such a shrewd operator, he was able to put it together. He was able to form alliances with Nancy Reagan, with Mike Deaver, who was like family to the Reagans, and he was able to prevail. And really, without Jim Baker, there would have been no Reagan Revolution. So has it been done? Yeah. How many Jim Bakers are there around? How many Leon Panettas are there? You know, Kelly's got a chance, but I'm afraid he's no Jim Baker.
Well, he supposedly, though, people say he's a general without little experience, particularly with Congress. My understanding was that he worked for both Secretary of Defense in the Bush
Gates
White House.
Panetta.
And also for Panetta, for both right. Gates and Panetta. And in that role, he was a liaison to the Congress. So, a lot of people, at least that work with him in those capacities, say he's really a great guy. Of course, our next guest wrote a piece saying that he's unhinged. So, why don't you try and defend the guy?
Listen, I would strongly suggest that if he hasn't done it already, Kelly should pick up the phone and call Jim Baker. The first thing Baker will tell him is, congratulations, you've got the worst blanking job in Washington. But then he'll go on to give him constructive advice. I would say call Ken Duberstein, who came in and picked up the pieces after Iran-Contra and helped Reagan successfully finish his second term. I'd say call Panetta. He's worked with Panetta. I think what all of them will tell him is that unless he is empowered by Donald Trump to be first among equals, and unless everybody reports through him to Trump, that this is mission impossible.
Well, Chris Whipple, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Chris Whipple, who's a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth, behind-the-scenes look at the men who have been the president's close advisors, from interviews with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents, whose members have included Rahm Emanuel, Dick Cheney, Leon Panetta, and Donald Rumsfeld, a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes and ABC News' Primetime. Chris Whipple is the writer and executive producer of The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the columnist for the Boston Globe, who wrote the article back in April, Homeland Security's John Kelly is Unhinged. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, a columnist for the Boston Globe, who served in the United States State Department as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. He's the author of American Maelstrom, the 1968 presidential election and the politics of division. He also wrote an article in the Boston Globe back in April, Homeland Security's John Kelly is Unhinged. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And do you still think that he's unhinged? Because he said he's working for a president who many people think is unhinged. So that's a double whammy.
Well, I would say taking a job as White House Chief of Staff that does lead to legitimate questions about one's mental health at this point, I would say. But, you know, the column I wrote back in April was focused on Kelly's rhetoric around the immigration ban, around the threat from terrorism. And what's striking to me about Kelly is not only is he an A-plus threatmonger and scaremonger and fearmonger who talks about terrorism and the threat from immigrants in existential terms, but he's clearly aping the rhetoric of the White House, of Trump, of Steve Bannon, of other folks inside the White House who have adopted a very harsh anti-immigration agenda. And so I think from that perspective, you know, it's hard to view Kelly as somebody who is going to be the guy to come in and shake heads and, you know, push Trump in the right direction. With anything, he's been an enabler of Trump's worst instincts and this administration's worst instincts.
But do you think there's a wider power play here involved in Trump taking this Homeland Security head into the White House as his chief of staff after having unceremoniously fired Reince Priebus, ordering him to swat flies in the Oval Office? Oh, my God. But the point I want to make is that, is this possibly a way to ease Jeff Sessions out of the DOJ into Homeland Security, where he's a good fit since he's obsessed with the border and immigration? Is that going on behind the scenes?
At this point, I would seriously doubt that would happen. I think Sessions is not going to leave DOJ unless Trump fires him. And it would be very strange after all the terrible things that Trump said about Sessions to then move him over to Homeland Security. I think at this point, this is really just about Trump wanting to get rid of Priebus and bring a general in, because he has a childlike fetishization of guys in uniforms. And so I think he just thinks someone in a uniform is somebody who can, you know, bring order and stop all the leaks in the White House, which, of course, is not going to happen. But I think that's probably what his mindset is. But I think also to go back to the point I made earlier, I think also the issue is that Kelly has been a loyal soldier. You know, Kelly has been the person who has carried out these immigration raids, who has used some of the same divisive, I would say somewhat racist rhetoric about illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants. And so I think in that sense, he views Kelly as somebody who will do his bidding. And that's really all that Donald Trump really wants, is not somebody that's crystal order, but somebody who will do what he wants them to do.
So the idea that we have these adults in the rooms, these generals, Mattis and McMaster, and the idea that there's a third adult in the room, I mean, the point that some people have made is that maybe these guys aren't even in the room. Maybe he doesn't listen to Mattis and McMaster. So you're saying he's not likely to listen to this guy as an adult. He just wants him to be a loyal soldier.
I mean, I'm old enough to remember when people said that bringing in McMaster to the NSC would bring the adults back into the White House and create, you know, more coherence on foreign policy. And, you know, how has that worked out? Of course, it hasn't happened at all, because Trump, you know, does what he wants to do and doesn't listen to anybody. Mattis has been, has certainly been, I think, more effective at DOD, but more because he's not in the White House, but certainly on a number of key issues, from torture, from the transgender ban that Trump announced recently, to even the Paris Climate Treaty, he's ignored Mattis' advice. So I don't see much evidence that the so-called adults in the room are having any real impact on Trump's thinking. He is the president, and he is somebody who is incapable, I think, of being directed by anybody, and not a person alive. He's directed by his own ego and his own, poor impulses, and I don't expect Kelly to be any different.
Well, the problem, I think, with too many generals, and not that, as we've discussed, perhaps they don't even have his ear. I mean, you mentioned he loves generals and people in uniform. He also loves hedge fund guys like Scaramucci. So that's an odd bifurcation there. But given what you wrote about in your article back in April in the Boston Globe, Michael Cohen, Homeland Security's John Kelly is unhinged. You quote him saying, "Make no mistake, we are a nation under attack, and we are under attack every single day. The threats are relentless." Is that the problem, that a guy that has a hammer sees everything as a nail?
I think, yes. I mean, to some extent, with Kelly, he clearly is somebody who is a very black and white guy. Like a lot of military folks, he has a real tunnel vision. He views terrorism as a threat and doesn't sort of see, I think, the larger context of how terrorism, the role of terrorism in international relations or, larger political issues. I think even just he's obsessed with his own brief. His brief is pressing against terrorism, pressing against, undocumented immigrants, then that becomes the most important issue in the world. And it's not unusual for somebody in that kind of position to then exaggerate the threat. It's exaggerate, the dangers that they're dealing with on a daily basis. So I think part of the rhetoric is just, part of what happens when you have a sort of military mindset. And sort of, I think Kelly demonstrates that. But I think it's also an indication that Kelly is very much of a loyal soldier and will do what the president wants him to do and wants him to say. That's not the description of somebody who's going to come into the White House and, sort of shake Trump by the lapels and get him to be a more disciplined president. I think you look at someone like Scaramucci, too, and this is another example. Scaramucci got this job because he never says a bad word of the president and because he says nice things about the president on TV. Trump wants to be surrounded by sycophants, people who basically tell him how great he is. Who don't question him, who don't push him, who don't confront him. And that's Scaramucci, and that seems to be Kelly to some extent. And so, you've got a president who already doesn't listen to anybody, but doesn't hear bad news, doesn't hear alternative viewpoints or ignores them. And now he's surrounding himself with people who are less likely to give him harsh news or give him, candor. So I think, this just creates... Puts Trump in even more of a situation in which he's unlikely to. He's positioned more to keep doing what he's been doing, and to keep tweeting and to keep saying things that are offensive and that violate norms and that are illegal and so forth. I don't see any reason to believe that's going to change, and that people around him are people who are more likely to enable that than they are to stop it.
No, indeed, not only is Donald Trump ruining America's domestically and it's the opinion of mankind globally, is also, I think, ruining the very office of the presidency, or at least lowering it to the point where it's embarrassing. And again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, a columnist for the Boston Globe, who previously served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. He's the author of American Maelstrom, the 1968 presidential election and the politics of division. And he wrote a column in the Boston Globe back in April, Homeland Security's John Kelly is Unhinged. What was the local reaction since the Boston Globe? Kelly is a Bostonian, I believe. Did you get any pushback from that?
No. In fact, oddly enough, that piece came out in April, and for yesterday and Friday, it was the most popular piece on the Globe site. I think that I don't think there's a lot of affection for Kelly just because he's from Massachusetts. I think, especially for folks on the left, I think they view anybody connected to Trump as in negative terms. I was happy to give John Kelly the benefit of the doubt, but he's demonstrated. As Homeland Security Secretary, that he is as problematic of a cabinet secretary as any of Trump's cabinet secretaries. I think that's partly, by the way, where we are right now in American politics. The polarization is so incredibly intense, and I think I think people, especially on the left, are responding very overwhelmingly to criticisms of this administration.
Well, I think that fundamental problem is Trump sees himself as a family in this delusion of power that he has. And he does have real power at his fingertips. He has the power to destroy the world, after all. But I think the problem here is that he sees himself as a ruler, and he doesn't know how to govern, and he doesn't have any interest in governing. And how can this guy who Trump treats all of his subordinates, sometimes as he's done with Priebus, in the most demeaning way, having him run around the Oval Office swatting flies. What's he going to do with this guy? Is he going to treat him as a subordinate, or is he going to allow him to do his job?
Of course he'll treat him as a subordinate. I mean, I would expect nothing else. That's what I would... I don't expect in any way this to be any different. You know, he will treat Kelly as he's treated everyone else around him. I mean, maybe he'll be... my understanding with McMaster now is that he's basically tuned McMaster out for the most part. And there's been some hinting in the press that he's looking to fire him. And to move him, and to move Pompeo from CIA over to the NSC. You're dealing with somebody who is basically a child, and somebody who has who expects to get their way and doesn't like to get told he's wrong. And I just don't expect to see anybody coming in there and able to be sort of the adult in the room, as people like to say.
So you don't think he'll be able to curtail this extraordinary situation where all kinds of people have walk-in privileges into the Oval Office, including Amoroso, the African-American lady who is like his chief cheerleader? I mean, it's pretty surreal, isn't it?
I suppose it's possible that you'll have a situation in which Kelly will be able to make the trains run on time more effectively inside the White House, you know, but... Again, it's and I said this yesterday. I mean, you know, giving Kelly this job is sort of like, you know, making him captain of the Titanic after the ship hit the iceberg, right? I mean, you know, perhaps it'll be more orderly for a short time, but the ship is still going down, and so you know, the pressures on this White House, the incapacity of the president, you know, the investigations into Russia and the potential collusion, that's not going away. It's only going to get worse, and so I think. You know, it's again, I mean, it's to use analogy again, it's like moving deck chairs in the Titanic. You're not going to really be able to, I think, have an effect what is happening in a really significant way. Anybody, I don't think anybody can change it.
Right, but to use the Titanic analogy, the Republicans in the House and Senate, the enablers, I like the ship, the California, that was close by the Titanic and ignored the fact that it was sinking and thought the flares, distress flares, were in fact
right.
A fireworks show. They seem to be completely, I mean, are they going to come around? I think McCain clearly made a stand, and I think that kind of woke them up. But the idea of McCain's call for regular order, that's what people think that Kelly's going to do in the White House. He's going to bring about regular order. You're telling us that that's not likely to happen. How long are these guys?
I don't have any reason to
believe it. But how long are the enablers going to go along with this delusion that they actually have a president, a competent, sane president?
I mean, as long as it's in their interest to do so. I mean, clearly, the folks inside in the Republicans in Congress have decided that it is in their interest to, you know, enable Trump's behavior and to not scrutinize the terrible thing that he does and says, because in the end they want him to sign laws, they want him to sign their priorities, and beyond that, I think there's a much more elemental issue here, which is that they're afraid of his supporters. You know, they don't want to upset Trump supporters, they don't want to upset the Republican voters who still like Trump. So there's no real incentive for them to go after him in a serious way. And I mean, you've seen that for the past 6 months. I see no reason. I mean, at some point, what I would say about this, at some point, Republicans will decide it's no longer in their interest to be supporting Trump, but we're nowhere near that point as far as I'm concerned. And you know, the death of the healthcare may change things somewhat, because it does sort of, I think, show, you know, that even having Trump in the White House doesn't really, if you can't pass laws in the House and Senate, it doesn't really matter who's in the White House. You know, but I think there probably are enough Republicans who hold out a pipe dream about getting tax reform, so they'll hold off and do anything until that has run its course. But they're playing with fire politically. I mean, at some point, it's going to come back and bite them. I mean, in 2018, it's most likely time is going to bite them. They are putting themselves in political danger by running the president. And every single senator, all 49 of them, voted for that bill in the Senate that would take away health care from, you know, 16 million people or more. Have put themselves in political danger. You know, they may think in the short term it's a good thing to do. They'll avoid a primary challenge on the right. Okay, but in the long term, you know, this is gonna, they're going to pay a price for this. And but that price may not come until November 2018.
Sure. And they voted for something that they literally did not know. There was nothing. They didn't know what was
in it. They didn't want to pass.
They didn't.
They voted, they did not want to become law.
Right.
It's surreal.
And it was an act of reckless cynicism on their part. I thank you for joining us, Michael Cohen. This is a very depressing time for the nation, and we can only hope that things get better, but no, the indications are that they're going to get worse.
Unfortunately, I think you're right.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a columnist for the Boston Globe, who previously served in the U.S. Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. He's the author of American Maelstrom, the 1968 presidential election and the politics of division. And he wrote a column in the Boston Globe back in April, Homeland Security's John Kelly is Unhinged. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Caracas, Venezuela for this critical day, which may spell the end of democracy in Venezuela.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Phil Gunson, the Andes Project Senior Analyst with the International Crisis Group, who conducts advocacy on political issues in the Andes region, focusing primarily on the Venezuelan political situation. He has spent almost 40 years reporting on Latin America for the BBC, The Guardian, Newsweek, The Miami Herald, and The Economist. And in the 1980s, he covered the wars in Central America. And in the late 90s, he was a Latin American correspondent for The Guardian based in Mexico City. He has co-authored two books on the region, including a two-volume political dictionary of Latin America and the Caribbean. Welcome to Background Briefing, Phil Gunson.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us, Phil. And the Venezuela, or at least Venezuelan democracy, appears to be at the crossroads. Is it that stark that this vote today that the opposition is boycotting to create a constituent assembly will be the beginning of the end of representative democracy in Venezuela?
I think, unfortunately, it's more like the end of the end. Ever since Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999, and came to power democratically, it has to be said. The government has tried, both under Chavez, under his successor, Nicolas Maduro, to reduce more and more the democratic space. Previously, under Chavez and in the early Maduro years, they were able to win elections, and the votes were counted correctly. And then, at the end of 2015, the opposition won a large majority in the country's parliament. And it seems from that point on, the government made a decision that really elections were not the way to go. And this election today, it really isn't competitive at all. It only includes candidates for the government side. And if this constituent assembly is installed, as it undoubtedly will be, then essentially Venezuela will be a dictatorship. There will be no democratic space left at all.
So are the opposition in boycotting it, are they enabling the inevitable? I mean, was that tactically the only move they could play?
Well, it was really, because the first of all, the Constituent Assembly is in the Constitution of 1999 that Chavez himself introduced. But it's quite clear in the Constitution that there has to be a referendum before a vote is held, and that referendum wasn't held. The people weren't asked. Polls make it clear that the vast majority of Venezuelans don't want the constitution rewritten. So it's illegitimate, but also the vote
voting system was rigged in such a way that even had the opposition put up candidates, there was no doubt at all that the government would have a large majority.
And there's been some violence today, has there not? One of the candidates for the Constituent Assembly was killed along with a youth secretary of the opposition, Action Democratic Party. What else can you report in terms of what's happening today?
Yes, that candidate was the second candidate to have been shot dead during the campaign. In the last 12 hours, unofficially, we've had 8 deaths reported, most of them apparently activists and demonstrators for the opposition. Most of them appear to have been shot dead, as far as we can tell. As I say, there are no official statistics yet. There has been considerable violence, particularly in the Andes region. A lot of people have tried to, and in many cases succeeded, to invade polling stations, destroy the voting material. There have been quite severe clashes here in Caracas as the opposition tried to mount a demonstration on the main highway that runs through the city. They were dispersed quite violently by national police and National Guard. And the opposition has now called on people basically to erect barricades in their own neighborhoods.
And during the boycott vote, the recent boycott vote, I believe a fairly elderly woman, she was a nurse, was murdered by the colectivos, the roaming band of vigilantes that support Maduro.
That's right. In the west of Caracas, a line of voters came under fire from these civilian pro-government gunmen, and several people were injured. This unfortunate woman died on the spot. She was the only death on that particular day. And in fact, that was the only major violent incident. Most of the rest passed off calmly today. And this particular vote has not passed off so calmly as that.
So tell us about the role of Cuba in all of this. There does appear to be a peculiar relationship. It's not sure clear who's the dog and who's wagging the tail of the dog. But Venezuela, of course, has in many ways aided the Cuban economy enormously after the Soviets collapsed and the oil supplies and subsidies were cut off. The country, Cuba, was in terrible trouble until Venezuela came through with subsidized oil. And I think in exchange for that, the Cubans have sent over thousands and thousands of teachers and other personnel, including intelligence people. So I know the opposition keeps saying that the Cubans are behind the end of democracy, but can you make a case that's going on behind the scenes?
Well, yes. As you say, it's behind the scenes, a lot of it, and so it's not always possible to know exactly what role they're playing and what advice they might be giving to Nicolas Maduro at the moment. He tends to fly off to Havana whenever he's in a particularly tight spot, presumably to get advice from the Havana regime. At the height, Venezuela was supplying about 100,000 barrels of oil a day to Cuba, essentially free. And the teachers and medical personnel and so on that you refer to were actually also getting paid. So Venezuela net was paying out, both in goods and in cash, a very large amount of money, which has, of course, become extremely important to Cuba. One imagines that the Cubans are very nervous at the possibility that the Maduro government might come to an end and might be replaced by a much less friendly regime in Caracas. And I think they could pose us a bit of an obstacle if we ever get to the point where this is where the two sides sit down properly to negotiate. The Cubans may have to be somehow compensated for not standing in the way of a return to democracy. But it's difficult, you know, because all of this or a lot of it is happening behind the scenes, the advice, the intelligence personnel, and so on. It's really hard to say whether the Cubans have decided that the end is inevitable, or whether they still think that it's possible for the Maduro government and whoever succeeds him on the Chavista side to establish and maintain a viable government, because this doesn't look viable economically, socially, politically. It's internationally isolated. It doesn't appear to be going anywhere, but of course it still has the army.
Well, that's what's puzzling. Normally, in these conditions, some kind of military coup takes place. And back in 1992, of course, there was a premature coup conducted by Chavez. My understanding is that the Cubans behind the scenes have gone to great lengths to sort of control, if you will, the colonels, the very people that would, be inspired by patriotic duty to mount a coup as a civilian government collapses, as this one appears to be.
Yes, I think that's right. The armed forces have been purged. Anybody who seems to be a dissident is kicked out very smartly, and the Cubans have played a big role in that because people who've left the armed forces at different levels, different ranks, have said that the Cubans are a presence in every one of the barracks, that they watch very carefully what Venezuelan officers do. It's also been, the armed forces have also been restructured several times under Chavez and also under Maduro. There's been restructuring which has really made it much more complicated to stage a coup. The hierarchy, the pyramidal structure of a normal armed forces has to some extent been subverted. And it's difficult both from the point of view of organizing without being detected and also just getting together the kind of critical mass that you would require to stage a coup. So most military experts don't think a coup as such is very likely. It might be that if Maduro felt the need to call the army onto the streets to actually shoot demonstrators, that would be a turning point, and that if not a coup, then what we would see would be at least a number of units, a number of commanding officers basically not answering the telephone to the president, and that certainly could bring down the government. But for now, it does appear that the government retains enough military support to keep it in power.
Well, it has the National Guard and the colectivos, doesn't it? So does it need the army?
Well, so far it hasn't, and the army has had the luxury of being able to sit in its barracks and grumble, but it hasn't been on the front line. And, of course, the army, for the most part, is not trained in riot control. So if the army is brought onto the streets, the death toll could get much higher. I think a lot of army officers throughout the armed forces in the different branches are well aware that they could be personally prosecuted for human rights abuses if that were to happen. That the fact that they were following orders would not save them. So, you know, at the moment, as I say, they have the luxury of not having to make the decision. But if they were called onto the streets, and it could happen, then that might make the difference.
But when you said earlier, Phil Gunson, that the both sides are going to sit down, I wasn't aware that that was likely, because one of the rumors that one heard about Maduro's determination to create this constituent assembly and to bypass the Congress itself and to render them completely irrelevant, there was also talk that he may actually start arresting them. So,
yes, indeed. It's true. I mean, the government talks about dialogue, and it says, the president has said several times, that this whole constituent assembly plan is intended to bring peace to Venezuela, and that if the opposition doesn't want to sit down to talks, he will oblige them to sit down to talks, which may be slightly contradictory. But paradoxically, throughout this period, and in the last few weeks even, in the run-up to the vote today, there have been talks between the government and the opposition, brokered by the Spanish former premier, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, and sponsored, if you like, by the Spanish embassy. They haven't come to anything. There has not been, on the part of the government, a sufficiently attractive offer for the opposition to consider seriously or to really sit down to proper talks. And I think if that were eventually to happen, as I hope it will, because the alternative appears to be a violent resolution of the conflict, then there needs to be a proper structure. There needs to be full international mediation with proper guarantees. There needs to be a seriously well-constructed agenda with timetables, with rules and regulations about who says what when and what kind of agreements, partial agreements might be reached, confidence-building measures and so on. None of that has happened, and I think it will only happen if the government gives signals, strong enough signals, convincing enough signals, that it really is prepared to negotiate. Because up to now, what we've seen is the release of a few political prisoners from time to time, but the number always goes up. There are more than 400 political prisoners right now in Venezuela, despite the partial releases that have been from time to time. So at the moment, although there have been talks about talks, nothing concrete is really happening.
So given the Trump administration's threat to impose sanctions if the Constituent Assembly vote passes, which it inevitably will, right, because the opposition are boycotting it.
Yes.
So in the context of what you just described, Phil Gunson, it seems like the Trump administration's position will not be helpful at all. I mean, first of all, what's the point of sanctioning a country where the people are starving and they can't get food supplies and medicines?
Yes.
What's the point of that?
That's a point that's been made by spokespeople for the opposition, by a lot of international organizations, ourselves included. I was in Washington just a few days ago making this point, and I found a lot of receptivity among the sort of policymaking establishment. They understand that point very well. I think the point of sanctions is, obviously what you hope is that the threat of sanctions will change people's behavior. And when it doesn't, you then have to decide what kind of sanctions you're going to impose. I hope they're imposed intelligently, gradually, and that they're aimed at the people in power rather than the people who, as you say, are in many cases eating food out of the garbage in Venezuela and failing to get medicines to save their lives. We don't want more suffering of that kind. But it is interesting that it's not just the United States that's threatening sanctions. The unprecedentedly for Latin America, several governments have stepped up and said that they too will impose some kind of sanctions. That includes Mexico and Colombia in the past few days. As I say, in Latin America, that's extremely unusual, and it's very interesting that this is a real multilateral initiative. There's a very strong sense now, rather belatedly perhaps, in the international community that it's not just a case of saving Venezuelan democracy and restoring some kind of welfare to well-being to the Venezuelan population, but if Venezuela does implode, then the impact on the region and on the wider world is not going to be a small thing. There are many, many ways in which the collapse of Venezuela can have a quite severe effect beyond its borders.
Isn't it already having an effect on Colombia? I saw some video the other night of families crossing the bridges into Colombia, and these were really obviously pretty destitute working class people, who many of whom were in tears that they were having to leave their homeland with scant possessions simply to survive.
Yes, indeed, there is an impact on Colombia. In the last few days, the Colombian government has been keen to play down the sort of air of crisis around that exodus. It is true that a lot of Venezuelans go across the border every day to buy things they can't find in Venezuela, and then they go back. The important thing is how many are left at the end of the day. The Colombian ombudsman said a week or so ago that the net exodus daily was around 5,000 Venezuelans. But obviously that could get a lot worse, and the Constituent Assembly plan and everything that goes with it is likely to make the exodus worse. It's an exodus that's being felt in the north of Brazil as well, in the islands to the north and northeast of Venezuela. But it's not just refugees. It's also political violence that could spread, organized crime, particularly drug trafficking, of course. The spread of disease is another serious concern. The Venezuelan health system is breaking down. There are no vaccines. The hospitals don't have any medicines or equipment. So there's a whole number of things that the international community has to worry about that are not simply to do with the fate of Venezuelans themselves.
But just to sort of pull back to the wider picture for a moment, it seems inconceivable that the country with the second largest oil reserves in the world is in this dire situation. It's my understanding is that Chavez, not Chavez, but Maduro, has about, at the most, 20% popularity. So you have about 80% of the country against him. The place has been circling the drain for some time, collapsing. People have been going through an enormous hardship. It has one of the highest crime rates in the world. And at this point, this incredibly unpopular person is pulling off a constitutional coup to enable him to preside over the mess that he's made without any opposition.
That's right. It's immensely paradoxical. The government, both Chavez and Maduro, over a period of not much more than 10 years, went through $1 trillion in government income. That's in a country of 30 million people, less than a tenth the size of the United States. And there's nothing to show for it. The infrastructure has collapsed. Most of the money appears to have been either frittered away, paid out in support for foreign friends, placed in bank accounts belonging to people in the regime or linked to the regime. And meanwhile, they've applied at home in Venezuela an economic policy that has succeeded in wrecking an economy that ought to be in really great shape right now, despite the relatively low oil prices. What we're looking at is an economy with inflation that's heading for over 1,000% a year. GDP has collapsed by roughly a quarter, I think, in the last few years. Imports are down by about 75%. And of course, since there's nothing being produced locally except oil, because the government expropriated local manufacturers or crushed them with exchange and price controls that left them with no breathing space, there's neither local production nor are there imports to make up the shortfall, which of course is a large part of the reason why people are going hungry.
Well, just in the last 30 seconds, you say that there's some hope with the Spanish intermediary, but the place is in fact poised for civil war by the sound of it. So which is it?
Well, I don't think civil war is the likeliest possibility unless the armed forces were to split, because the opposition, for the most part, is unarmed. I think we'll see a lot of repression, a lot of violence, a further economic and social collapse. But my hope is that before too long, the government will realize that this really isn't viable, that the situation is going to implode, that the government and the regime as a whole are going to collapse, and that the best thing to do, even for them, is to negotiate while they still have something to negotiate with.
Well, Phil Gunson, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Caracas, Venezuela.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Phil Gunson, who's the Andes Project Senior Analyst with the International Crisis Group, who conducts advocacy on political issues in the Andes region, focusing primarily on the Venezuelan political situation. He has spent almost 40 years reporting in Latin America for the BBC, The Guardian, Newsweek, The Miami Herald, and The Economist. In the 1980s, he covered the wars in Central America, and in the late 1990s, he was Latin American correspondent for The Guardian, based in Mexico City, and he's co-authored two books on the region, including a two-volume political dictionary of Latin America and the Caribbean. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.